Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2024. Today, free cash flow analysis part two, and I will spend a happy amount of time. And as I said, chapter 12 is voluntary. You can take it if you pass. But the problem is that if you start it, you're going to get scored, and then that score goes into your homework average. If you don't take it, then it just isn't there. It's not one of the homeworks that's counted for your grade. And it's not one of them that's dropped either. So you have to decide which way you want to haul that thing. Now, as far as I'm concerned, what I did on Monday and what I do today will be the extent of what I expect you to know about free cash flow analysis. And it's all the words, the terms, and the concepts behind it, not the math. And then at, 1:20, I open up the quiz at 7, and when you finish it, that's all I have for you, and I will thank you. But for now, just a quick look at the numbers, just to see how grim the day is. The markets are still in a sour mood. As you see, it's another bear day. It started out on a happy note, and then it just slid off from there. However, it did not drop strongly, and there's a recovery underway right now. The markets are trying to crawl back out of the hole here in the afternoon, which indicates that the worst of the bearish sentiment coming from the bad news of earlier this week and all of last week is finally beginning to shake out through from the market, and we're getting back into a better position. And on another bright note, you will see that crude oil is now getting down to the low end of that trading band. It seems like it likes to bounce back and forth between the upper and lower. But this time, as you can see, crude is dropping off the face of the earth. It's gotten clear down to $82.79 a barrel on the light sweet Brent, and that's a good news. That means lower gas prices may be coming in the next week or two, or not. We'll see. But gold is showing no signs of an apocalypse coming. We don't see any massive increase in the price of gold. Matter of fact, gold is now sliding again, which is more good news, because if gold is going up, that means that investors are throwing money at gold and getting out of everything else. Now, as a look at the bond market, well, thank goodness we have the bond yields beginning to fall. In other words, short-term rates are showing that tendency downward, which we need to keep the economy's recovery going. Bonds right now are down, about 6 basis points? In other words, yields are down. That means prices are up. So that means that investors are buying into bonds. They're getting back into the game, at least in the bonds, if not the equity. And that means that we've got lower yields because the prices are going up on bonds. That means the yields are sliding. And that should help us with these interest rates, which we're beginning to show some real serious signs of rising again, especially mortgage interest rates. And with this slide off in the bond yields, that we hope that will bring the rise in interest rates to a halt, and we'll start having them fall again here in the next few weeks or so, next few days to weeks, I should say. Running over here, Nikkei Tokyo doesn't have a good feel. It's bear market. It tried to get back up to level about midday last night in Tokyo. Just didn't want to do it. By the end of the day, it was down a pretty noticeable 1.3%. So Japan's economy seems to be not something that's exciting investors at all right now. But London, for once, they're still trading, and it was rising there for a while. It had gotten up to almost 55.60 about an hour or so ago, but it's sliding back off. But they may finish the day on a positive note, which is better news than you usually see over there in London right now. But the overall picture, the Fed is, and we'll talk about the Federal Reserve next week, and what they say is influential. Not just what they do, but what they say. And the chairman of the Fed, he said bluntly, we haven't killed inflation yet. It's still out there. And that means that they can't relax and let interest rates go down. They can't relax and let the money supply expand, not until they are sure inflation is dead. And the chairman said, it's not. We've got the numbers. The things, inflation still keeps popping back up. So they're just going to keep the brakes on it. Now, that gets to be an interesting political issue, because as you go toward the election, the direction of the economy, the direction of interest rates, the directions of those economic numbers begin to have their influence on the outcome of elections. And that will affect every candidate for office, including the president, the office of the presidency. Obviously, there are other social issues that come into play strongly, but there is a lot of influence of where people think we are in the economic cycle. If people think we're doing good, they will tend to keep the party in power that has been there. But if they think that the economy is sliding, they don't care why. They will crucify the party in power. And that has happened in the past. So you see the politicians behind the curtain are watching this themselves and hoping for whichever way they want the economy to go. Obviously, the Republican candidate would want the economy to be heading to hell so that people will vote against the incumbent. The incumbent, on the other hand, hopes to God that the economy is doing well so people feel like that's a good president. We want to keep this guy in power. So you lay your bets on what's coming over the next 6 months, and that will be about what will happen with the election in November. As we used to say in Chicago, remember to vote early and often. That's an inside Chicago joke from a long time ago. But anyway, enough of that. Let me take you on a journey. Now, when I do free cash flow analysis, there I've got spreadsheets, and I'll make those available if you want to learn how to actually do free cash flow analysis. And if you take a higher level finance course, we'll go through the numbers of it. And we praise the high heavens for Excel these days, because it makes it a lot easier to do this. But at the bottom line of free cash flow analysis is real business and real basics and principles that matter to not just finance majors or to accounting majors. They matter to any kind of a business person. Free cash flow is what we actually do care about, not profit. I probably told you the story, though. It was a very large company, an international company, not too far from here. Some years back, we had one of those alumni meet the finance students get-togethers up in Chicagoland. We had it at a really nice all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet, and they made a big room for us. And we had this panel of four ISU alumni and who were in the business world up there. And one of them, they were telling what they've experienced out there in the real world as opposed to what is in college. And one of them was talking about her company. Like I said, she had come to this from her position in what we call treasury, the finance department. She said her company had been profitable for a long time. Profits were doing really well. But she said, anyone in the C-suite or just below the C-suite knew that the company was not well. It was sick. It didn't feel well. There was a sense that this isn't working. Something is wrong here. And they could see it in the background numbers, even though you could play with the foreground numbers, the ones that are reported in the financial statements. Yeah, the company looks great. Net profit, return on equity, return on assets. But something was wrong. And she said, finally, some of the newer people who were in the company began to have a voice, and they said, that's because you're looking at net profit, your net earnings, and you're not looking at free cash flow. If you work your way down to the free cash flow, you see that this company's free cash flow has been shrinking, and it's heading toward negative territory. So even though the company is doing well on paper, the actual physical money going in and coming out, coming in and going out, is not good at all. In my own business, I was reporting profits every year in my consulting company. Why the hell then was Thursday night the worst night of my 2-week cycle? That was the night that I had to cut payroll checks so that my employees could get them in the next morning. Of course, they wanted them. And my God, it was like, where is the money going to come from? There were some times when I put money from my own account, my own savings account, into the company's checking account just so I could meet payroll. What the hell is wrong? That's cash flow. You see, those are bills. You can't just say, I'll pay you some other time. Like you can say on accounting statements when you can accrue wages payable. You can't do that. In the real world, you have to pay the bill. So that money that's a negative free cash flow, it has to come from somewhere. And that's what we care about. Now let's talk about this in a more practical way with bigger companies and all of that. The first thing is, and I said this a few of these things last week, but I'll go back through some of them and jump further on. Project, I'll find a marker that works. Project, oh good. Project analysis. There's kind of a rule in companies. In the background, a company is really just a portfolio of its assets, all of its projects, its retained things like that, its factories, its inventories, its all the different products that it makes or the services that it sells. It's really just a portfolio of those, all under one banner called the corporate entity. So the first thing we do when we take a project on, and this is something I said on Monday, and I want to emphasize it again, is that we do incremental analysis. When you are looking at new projects, they aren't part of the company yet. You cannot assume that they will do anything for or against the company. They stand incremental revenues. You look at only the revenues of the company, of the project, and the incremental costs. What those revenues of that project are, what those costs of that project are. And this is the part where you get the but, if, and you can't start with this. But let me start with revenues. There are two things that can happen. One is with revenues. You can have synergies and you can have cannibalism. In other words, the revenues of this project, we pretend that they have no effect. We have to say that. And if we are going to violate that, we have to have good reason. Synergies. What if a product that we are considering making actually helps the revenue of another product that we already have? That would be a synergistic effect. Some companies play these. I'll give you some examples. Printers. A printer, you can get printers at a really good quality, extraordinarily cheap. Sometimes they'll even throw in a printer with a computer that you buy. And it's like you just, well, would you like to buy a pro, have the printer package with your computer for an extra $40 or $50? That has been around for some years now. Selling printers. Now, you can get high-end printers that cost a fortune, but a basic printer is something you can buy at Walmart and with the dollars in your pocket. Why do they do that? Because the printer isn't the main show. Once you buy that printer, you will buy ink forever for it. And it will be a proprietary ink. You can use off-brand inks, but they warn you. And in fact, some printers, you can't put in a cartridge unless it reads to the original manufacturer, the OEM. And this is very common. HP has taken it one step further, where you buy the printer, you buy for a song, but then you have to buy their inks. And now they recommend that you buy HP paper for an HP printer. So you see how that printer can actually be on its own a loss. The revenues are pathetic, but what it does is it feeds the revenues of other products that the company is making. You make a dependency there, and that is a synergy. In fact, this is part of a much larger concept, a business model that really took hold not that many years ago. It was in your lifetimes, definitely, where a lot of software, including productivity apps and entertainment, you buy online. They're no longer shrink wrap. They're subscriptions. Because for a company, we don't really want you to have that utility that's talked about in marketing called ownership. Because a lump sum of money is not nearly as good as a cash flow for a long, long time. You can buy, give you an example. You can no longer buy Microsoft Office as a weakened version, but you have to buy a subscription now. Why? Because you have to have that subscription, and that subscription becomes a free cash flow item to the company forever, as long as you live. Adobe was very bold. It was one of the first to step up and say, you can no longer buy the Adobe Creative Suite. You must rent it. So in other words, if you've got a lot of images that are formatted in PSD for Photoshop, well, if you stop paying that subscription fee, you can't access your photos anymore, can you? To further enhance them or whatever. They've got you a cash flow instead of a lump of money. I have the last paid version of the Master Suite. It costs more than $2,000. If I can't upgrade it, because if I did, all I could do is a subscription. In other words, they'd get me for the cash flow. Another great place is in medical equipment. You can get a diabetes measure machine for a song, but there's a subscription, and then they can sell you all of the products that go with it. The alcohol pads, the little sticky things that hurt like hell when you jab them into you, all that. They're creating a cash flow. The machine the revenues will be pathetic, but it's off those other products, the synergistic effect on other products. Many companies now, it's unfortunate to say it, but many illnesses are no longer for a company, for a drug manufacturer, for a medical services company. Those illnesses are no longer diseases. They are lifestyles. You no longer have diabetes. You have a diabetic lifestyle, complete with the meal plans, complete with the exercise plans. They can keep going at you, give you the original, yes, we care, here is your equipment. And then for the rest of the time, it's a free cash flow going to them from all of the sphere of services and products around it. That's how it works. So, yes, sometimes you can't talk about incremental, just this project, because that project may be actually even designed to fuel the revenues of your existing product line. Possibly the latest, and it's a stupid one, did you possibly read about BMW? They were selling their BMWs, but you had to pay a subscription fee for the seats to be heated. So you're sitting there freezing your ass off until you pay a subscription fee so that they will turn on the heaters in your car seats. Now that's pretty lame if you ask me, but you see the idea of the synergistic effects of these. Their entire industries are now based upon products that are actually losses, but what we call loss leaders. But we know that once we have you on that core product, which came in at a low cost, then you are creating the environment for subscriptions that will be cash flow period after period for a long time. Now, if you're into the conspiracy theory kind of part of it, they say this even extends to illnesses like cancer. Cancer is not a disease, it is a lifestyle. We will sell you the products that will get you well again, or make you healthier, or keep you from getting cancer. So that the initial diagnosis you paid for is only a very small part of the sphere of services and products that will come after it. This is all part of the game, and you're in it. If you don't like it, well, there are other countries where they don't do this, but here we're capitalists, and anything that can make us a buck, we will do, as long as it's not too illegal or too unethical. Cannibalism. Oh, you do not want to have a product that eats up another product. You really, really don't. Because you could create, that's why this is a big thing. When we create this product, is it going to take revenues away from a product that we already have? This goes into issues in marketing of demographics, price discrimination, sectorization on demographics, psychographics, socioeconomic graphics. We want a product to not hurt our other products. Great example, cars. The starkest example. Does anyone know what company makes the cars that are called Lexus?
Toyota.
Yes, Toyota. But they sure as hell don't want to call them Toyotas, because if you call it a Toyota, it will take and eat into the revenues that you get from selling the high-end Toyotas. Infiniti. Does anyone know what Infiniti is? What is it?
Nissan.
They sure as hell don't want to sell an Infiniti that would take away from the revenue of a Nissan at the higher end. Honda. Does anyone know what Honda's label is for their high-end cars? The Acuras. They want it to be an Acura, not a Honda, because they don't want to cannibalize sales off one of their products, because they've got another product. that is basically pretty much a lot like the other one. In fact, it gets even more important than that. In car manufacturing, oftentimes what you'll see is a model, what they call model drift, where you have a car that was a low-end car, had a name, and over the and it was targeted to a younger demographic. And as time goes on, you see that car begin to get better and better looking, bigger. The RAV4 by Toyota was a classic example of that. Started out as a little cute four-seater buzzing around the highways. I used to take my truck and drive over them. But no, the point though is, though, have you seen the RAV4s now? They are big SUVs. Why? Because they moved it up with its demographic. And then once that demographic was locked in with that kind, that car, make and model, then they could bring in a lower end car underneath it for a new demographic at the bottom end. In other words, the models follow the demographic wave up. And they make sure that they stay with that demographic wave so that they don't cannibalize revenues from a lower end car that comes in later. This is cannibalism. It's really important to companies that they don't do this. Now, ultimately, what will happen is a product that is entering its decline phase, they will, at that time, they really don't worry too much about the cannibalism because they are not trying to keep that product from dying. Well, they know it will, but it will still be a cash cow for a long time, at least produce more, have old people who remember the old product, and they'll still stick with it. But the new waves, they will be seeing and they will be attracted to the newer products that the company has. But they won't let you see that they are the same or even similar to this old line of products that once were great but now are bought just by an old demographic or a low-income demographic. Now, cost. On the plus side, volume discount. Volume discount. Look, this project is going to have part of it, one of its something that goes into manufacturing that is also going into other products we have. So by buying more, you can negotiate better terms with your suppliers. So even though for incrementally, the cost per unit of this new product would be $18, because we are also buying this product, this input for other products, we can say, look, we're buying a lot from you, Mr. Supplier or Ms. Supplier. And now, why don't you give us a cut us a deal on all of our stuff? Let's say $17.20 per unit, because we're giving you a lot of business. So in other words, in this case, you wouldn't want to put the $18 down for the incremental cost of that input. You would want to put the $17.20 because you were going to get a volume discount because you were using that for other products. And it would save you money on those other products too. So sometimes you can get the volume discounts. But here is the other side, the darker side of that. Opportunity cost. The opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. The opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. The opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. It is one of the most catastrophically ignored and largest costs There is. It's not a cost that comes out of your pocket. It's revenue that does not go into your pocket. The opportunity cost kills projects if you consider it. A lot of projects that are positive net present value, you put in the opportunity cost, what you could have done instead. Suddenly, those are no-goes because you gave up revenue to gain revenue. And the question is, how much did you give up? What did you give up to do this? And that can be really a game changer. I can't remember at this late time in the semester if I told you. There was a, I won't mention the name of the city, right close by here, Bloomington. But years ago, they had this dream. Well, the mayor wanted something that would be her legacy. And so a sports arena idea was born. And they did a standard cash flow analysis, and I was teaching elsewhere at that time long ago, and she wanted to make a presentation to all of our business students. We're going to come in and show you how we made the decision to go with this magnificent project. And so she brought with her her finance guy. She had him on a nice leather collar and leash, and she said, "Come here, boy, sit, tell him all about it." So he pops this beautiful free cash flow analysis up there, and then asked the students, "Would you like to ask any questions?" Of course, no one asked any questions. They just wanted to go get out of there at this private university so they could go get high. And but they just quietly hoped that everyone would shut up and we could all leave. And I raised my hand. I see you don't have a line here for one of the costs, the cost of the land. And he immediately said, "Oh, we already own the land." You already own the land. Really? Well, he knew what was about to happen because that doesn't mean that it's not a cost. Because you see, they used the land for this sports arena, which means that they did not sell it to make scratch. They did not lease it out to some other company to build something there. That was a hidden cost, an opportunity cost of the best foregone alternative. That would have easily turned this positive net present value project into a negative net present value project. They ignored it, and they ignored a couple of other opportunity costs. And what happened? Well, at this point, it's that arena has been bleeding red for years. It has been a giant millstone around the city's neck for years. You understand that this is the real-life consequence of ignoring costs up front. Opportunity costs, if they had put it in there, they would have seen that overall this project was negative NPV at any reasonable discount rate. But they ignored it, and it looked great on paper. But it always comes back to bite you. It always comes back to bite you. So there is a layout of some of those big ones. Now I'm going to bring up something else here. And I've talked about this one before too. And here at the end, I'm going to do it again because sooner rather than later, you're going to be out there getting into the world, not just of business, but getting into the world of business decision making. Sunk cost. If you've already paid the money, it's gone. It's gone home to Jesus. It is not there anymore. It isn't. We've already put in $2 million, so we better keep going. That $2 million is nowhere. I've even asked that in meetings. Show me where the $2 million was. Well, it's out there. Uh-huh. Well, what are you going to do about that? Well, you know what you could do with that $2 million investment? You could sell it and get your recover. At least get some of it back. You could sell it. It's not part of your calculus now. It's over. It's not going to be part of the project. I have seen a number of companies, as a matter of fact, one that I show in a somewhat more advanced class, in their project, their it's classic NPV analysis they did, just like they're supposed to, but they included the plans and the all the blueprints, the plans, and getting the bids for the different costs that they were going to put in their analysis, all of the people that they hired to task to do the expert design of the product and all of that, and they included it in the first year's negative free cash flow, the investment, year zero. You know that negative number? All of that stuff, planning, was in there as a cost. It was something like, it was over $200,000. Why are you putting that in there? Well, because that was part of the project. But you've already spent the money, Cupcake. It's gone. You can't get that back now. It's over. Well, we spent the money. Well, good for you. Give yourself a cookie. It's not part of this analysis. Well, yeah, it is because it's part of the project. It's a part of the project that's already over. It's already done. You can't recover that. There's nothing that can be done. And that sounds a little weird at first. And they just fought until they, I tried to teach them my old-fashioned way. Look, you assholes, think. You're not looking at what is coming at us. You're looking at what's already happened back there. It's like on a battlefield. God, that shell landed behind me. I better be... No, you live through that, so you just keep going forward. You tell stories about it and the shrapnel in your butt, but you just keep going forward. That's the sunk cost. You can't consider it as part of it. Now, one that is aligned it's with this, and it's a little bit dicier to talk about here, but I want to bring it up one more time. I brought it up early in the semester. Replacement cost. Accountants live in the world of historical cost, cost basis. You, in your business life and in your personal life, can't do that. You have to look at what it will cost to replace something, not what you paid for it, what it will take to replace it. That's the forward-looking analysis. This is, we can't base on what has already happened. There will be inflation that will be involved. There will be economic depreciation. Whatever you see on those accounting statements is a dark and flawed representation of what is happening forward. And so you just ignore that original cost, and you look at what it would cost to replace this. In one case, okay, fine. You want us to? They had a piece of equipment. It was a crane, and it was a little crane. It was kind of adorable, but it was $400,000 when they bought it. So they said, fine. You're saying that we have to include that cost in the project? No, I'm not. I'm saying that you have to put in the replacement cost of that crane. You bought that 12 years ago. You ought to see the cost of one of those now. Well, we've got the one we've got. Doesn't matter. If that one breaks tomorrow, you're still going to have to pay replacement cost for the one that you will replace it with. So that's part of this too. It's a maddening process, but when you think about it, think in terms of finance, not in terms of accounting, and also think in terms for these incremental revenues and costs. Again, synergies and cannibalism, volume discounts and opportunity costs, those, well, certainly the synergies and cannibalism and volume discounts, you have to think about those. Can we really rely on this product helping other products with their revenue? Can we really rely on our product not to take up revenue that was in another product that we are already selling? And that's a huge one. You don't ever want to take away revenue from an existing product unless you are intentionally trying to kill that product. That brings me to the last example. It happened before your time, in the 1980s, at the end of the 80s, was it? Coca-Cola had been in business for nearly a century by that time, and it had a secret formula for making Coke. And it's a hidden formula, and they guard it with their lives. I think there's one copy in a vault somewhere, and then there's another copy one other place. I don't remember the details. But in the late 1980s, they thought about a decision. Let's change Coke. Let's make a new Coke. And they called it New Coke. Now, in blind taste tests, uniformly, the groups, test groups, said, oh, this is good. And they were rating it in the blind taste test higher than the classic, the Coke Classic. Just, it was better. It was. And I actually had some of it, and it was really good. So, what did they do? They actually deliberately cannibalized Coke Classic. It was gone from the shelves, and New Coke was on the shelves. And, of course, everyone and his mother said, it's horrible. Bring back Coke Classic. This is disgusting. They cannibalized their existing product because they thought New Coke was going to sell like hotcakes, and it was an absolute catastrophe. And of course, now, famously, the lesson, the questions, you know, what were the lessons learned by this? And you could debate that all day and all night, but it turned out that they ultimately had to completely clear the New Coke, retool everything back to the Coke Classic. It was a multi-tens of millions of dollars mistake, deliberately cannibalizing one product, because you got clear marketing data that the product cannibalizing the old product was going to sell better. Wait until the real world tells you what's going to happen before you deliberately cannibalize an old product with a new product. By the way, why did that happen? There's an ancient rule there. Don't mess with success. So if you got a new project, you be real careful about deliberate cannibalization, because even though it might be a lot better than the old product, people may very well hate it. You're going to see cars coming out in the next couple of years that no longer have those stupid screens on them. Those screens are incredible. They're very helpful. People hate them. They want to go back to the dials and the digital in the little dashboard. So they had cannibalized an older technology because they thought everyone's going to love a TV screen that shows you everything with GPS maps and TV shows and information about whatever crap you're listening to in the music stations. In real life, people didn't want it. They like things to be relatively the same. Doesn't matter the age group either. Especially we find that younger demographics, they say they want change and new, but then when they face the choice, in real life, they go with the old. You have a quiz to take now. When you're finished with it, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.